Loss and grief. Two things that we will never avoid in walking this earth. There's so much to this topic. And like many other topics, I want to make a lot of things that are hard to discuss a little easier just because we talked about it on Surfing the Quicksand. I hope you tune in and get a lot out of my guest today. She is a physician and an integrative health and wellness coach, and it's her life mission to help people navigate this. And you're going to get a lot out of it, just as I always do. I'm your host, Kathy Bynes. Today, we're talking about loss and grief. And these are really heavy topics, and a lot of people don't like talking about them, even in the most personal situations. But it's important to me through Surfing the Quicksand that we start to normalize some of these big, big things that impact midlife women, well, all of us, as we are navigating through this chapter. And I wanted to bring on a specialist who's going to help talk to us about loss and grief. My guest today is Larry Swanson. She's an integrative health and wellness coach and a physician. Her background's in integrative medicine and emotional wellness and behavior change. And she works with individuals and groups in areas of loss, chronic illness, caregiving stress, major life transitions, all of these really heavy topics that can weigh so heavy on our heads and our hearts and our lives. Her passion here is deeply personal, and we're going to talk about her background and what she brings to that work as she helps people navigate with understanding and compassion and resilience and grace. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you so much, Kathy. I'm really happy to be here with you.
I love that your story is that you started as a physician. Which I think is where so many people start in the I want to help people world. Can you be talking to us about your professional journey and how you kind of got from physician to health and wellness coach?
Absolutely. Thank you, Kathy. So currently, I am working, as you mentioned, as an integrative health and wellness coach. I also have my MD degree from the University of Minnesota. And over the years, because very much because of my life experiences, I have worked in medicine, medical research and writing, and integrative health and coaching. And what ultimately drew me into this latter work, the integrative health and the coaching, was recognizing that people are not simply physical beings. We're emotional, relational, spiritual, and psychological beings as well. I was trained in healthcare in, my medical training to focus on identifying and treating disease. But there was a lot less emphasis on helping people navigate the human experience, which includes suffering and uncertainty and change and loss. My own life, as I mentioned, profoundly shaped the direction that I took in my career. When I was much younger, actually not long after I graduated from medical school, my mother was diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. I found myself at the intersection of delivering medical care on the one hand and participating in it with my mom on the other. And ultimately, sadly, there was not much that the medical community had to offer her. And that's when I began exploring and learning about complementary and integrative care options. So, to make a very long story short, I was incredibly close to both of my parents. I'm an only child. I even say I was enmeshed with them. And watching my mother's decline was absolutely life-changing and devastating for me. From the moment she received her diagnosis, I started experiencing anticipatory grief, which is, that grief that comes from expecting a loss in your life. Then shortly after my mother died, I lost my father, and that season of life completely changed everything. And I like to say I had the first half of my life with my parents, and then kind of this moment where everything changed, and it took me, it was a season of grief for me. And when I started to come out of that season, I consider that kind of the second half of my life. During that season, I approached grief in every way that I could intellectually. I read everything that I could about grief. I sought counseling. I talked to the minister at my church. But ultimately, what helped me the most was just compassionate human connection, people who could sit with my pain without trying to fix it. And that experience kind of became foundational to my work today. I realized there is just a gap in the system, kind of, and how deeply people need spaces where they can be witnessed and heard and supported and reminded that grief is not pathology. It's not a disease. And a lot of people say that grief is love with nowhere to go, and that resonates with me. And so all of that eventually led me toward a career in grief coaching and grief circle work.
I thank you for sharing all that, and your experience is just unimaginable. I can appreciate that sense of being so close with your family and all of that changing, so quickly. And to talk about it as a season, my gosh, I think of seasons as 3 months. We have 4 seasons a year. They last 3 months, but I'm not getting the impression this was a 3 month journey for you to get to a point where you were on the other side of it. I love that idea, and I'll think about it. Finding what helped you was that people could sit with you but not fix it, right? And how meaningful that connection is, since, my gosh, how often are all of us just called into crisis and thinking, how can I help? What can I do? How can I fix it? And knowing that in the end, that wasn't actually what did it for you.
Right. And truly, I appreciate you using that word fix because we do. And as a medical caregiver, that was my job, was to fix things. And grief is something that can't be fixed. It has to be lived, it has to be experienced, it has to be processed, and eventually we come out the other side.
We're going to talk today about loss and grief and, again, midlife women as caregivers, because so much falls to us in that space. And I hope, what just occurred to me a little bit is also the how can I be a friend to someone who is grieving? I don't think that was on my mind before I hit record today, but I think that's on my mind now based on what you just shared. So let's talk about kind of the clinical side of this, the what is loss and what is grief. I know that it's really easy to start saying, for me, loss and grief is someone died, I'm grieving their loss, but there's so much more. Right, there's so much more, and you talked about anticipatory loss as one example. So I know there's so much more in loss. Let's start there with let's define loss in its many different flavors.
So I define grief as the natural, emotional, physical, mental, and spiritual response to losing someone or something that's meaningful to us. If we have loved deeply in our lives, if we have attached deeply, if we have even longed for something or hoped for something deeply, like for instance, we've grown up hoping to have children and that doesn't happen. If we've imagined a future that doesn't come into being, grief becomes a part of our human experience. And grief takes many, many forms. And so the one we all think of is, as you mentioned, grief after the death of someone we love. We We're all familiar with that. But then I also mentioned the anticipatory grief, which is grief experienced before an expected loss. And this can happen during illness, aging, major life transitions, even if someone is, approaching retirement, there can be a lot of anticipatory grief around that too. There's ambiguous loss, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more if I may after the many types of loss, but that's a loss that lacks a clear closure or understanding. Cumulative loss is the layering of many losses over time that compound emotional overwhelm and exhaustion. There's disenfranchised grief, which is grief that's minimized or unrecognized or unsupported by other people in society. And this is so common. And for instance, I believe you mentioned caregivers taking care of elderly parents with dementia. I mean, some people might say, well, at least you still have your parent. And so that, is a type of disenfranchised grief that, the grief is not fully recognized because the person is still living. And then, as I mentioned, there are non-death losses, which can include any kind of significant life change or ending. And I'm kind of going through one right now. My family just moved back to Minnesota, which is our home, from Florida. And although we're happy to be home, we had a stint in Florida for my husband's work. There was a kind of grief about leaving our friends down there, leaving our neighborhood, people that we care about. So that, even though the change was expected and it was positive, there's still a grief that can go along with that. And then, of course, there's identity loss. Grief connected to losing a sense of who you are due to life changes, illnesses, roles, or transitions in life. The empty nest is one that comes to mind because I'm not far out of the empty nest. Loss of purpose, loss of health, loss of relationships, estrangement, or moving, as I mentioned, loss of dreams that come with. Expectations that we've had in life that can no longer be realized. So,
I would just, can I go back? The one you talked about with moving and leaving Florida was really interesting because you couched it in there's sadness and grief among happiness, among silver linings, among bright parts. And so it feels like there's even a sense of conflict, like you're not truly fully in grief or. It can, must be hard to acknowledge grief when you're like, oh, but there's also all these positives in that sandwich. Does that feel right?
Yes, it does. And I think it's something that we all just kind of take for granted, the mixed emotions that come with big transitions in life. But it really hit me as we were packing and getting ready to move and saying goodbye to our friends. And hopefully we will keep in touch with them. But I found myself just exhausted, more exhausted than I expected to be with the move, and was kind of thinking about that. And it hit me, there is a sadness here that is weighing on me. And if I can allow myself to acknowledge it, to sit with it, to name it, I even went for a walk with some of my friends and said, you know what, I'm really grieving moving away from you. And I hope we'll keep in touch, but I know it's going to be different. And somehow, acknowledging and naming it gave me permission to feel exhausted and to get over it when the time came.
Yeah,
So,
that idea about naming it and acknowledging it feels really powerful, right? Because otherwise, you're like, I feel bad. I am overwhelmed. I am exhausted. I am tired. I am frustrated. I have a lot of things. But if I'm not able to kind of put a pin into why that is, I'm not really dealing with it.
right.
And that has to be part of that journey.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes. I'm a big proponent of naming, identifying the emotions that we're dealing with.
Okay. There are a couple of other losses that you mentioned in there that were kind of interesting to me, and I'm gonna get the term wrong, but it was kind of the one where you're being diminished or disenfranchised.
Yes.
That really was interesting. And again, I think that idea of the caregiver, right? The person of, they are in this kind of mix between worlds and a mix between realities. So how does grief show up in, when you are being diminished or at least not supported in the way you need? How does that show up? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. And I actually have a life experience that I can share about that type of grief as well. When our youngest child was 12, he came down with a virus that left him partially paralyzed. And he was hospitalized for 10 days. He was in the ICU. And thank God he did survive. And he is an amazing, amazing young man today, very successful, although still partially paralyzed. I had so many well-meaning friends who did not know really how to support me around that time. And they kept saying, "It's fine, it's fine. At least, he didn't die. He's here." And of course, that should go without even saying that makes all the difference. But there was still and is still a grief that I carry that his life turned out differently than we had hoped, that he has a disability that he will have for the rest of his life that makes life and certain things harder for him. And so I think I had to kind of find a balance and come to terms with acknowledging the grief that I do hold around that, but also celebrating, that I'm grateful that he is still here with us.
It's interesting. Gratitude is that feeling that came up for me as I'm imagining navigating through those conversations where your friends and everyone well-meaning is trying to get you to find the positive, to embrace to understand how much worse it could have been and really celebrate that, and that find the gratitude for the positive. But at the expense again of, well, actually, I am allowed, or am I allowed?
Yeah.
That is that question, right? Am I allowed to say, I can still mourn and grieve and suffer in silence or not in silence around the pain that I am feeling over this, while also possessing gratitude?
Yeah. Yes. That is so important. And you bring up kind of this concept of both and I do think with grief and emotions in general, often there are, both ends of the spectrum present at the same time. And that is one of kind of the myths of grief, I think, that you can have moments of happiness or joy in the midst of deep grief, and there is nothing wrong with you if that happens. And it doesn't mean that you care less. It's just how our brain is processing, how our bodies are processing. And so it can feel very confusing, when all of these emotions kind of show up at once or interact with each other.
And the last emotion to show up in that circus is always guilt, right?
Yeah,
Yes.
yes.
Because even as you're trying to struggle with that, if you're feeling guilty that you've let joy in or that you've acknowledged joy while clearly the headline should be suffering.
Yes, such a good point.
Yeah. I'm thinking about again that caregiver role, and so often that both and is the loss, but it's some for many people there's relief, right? There's relief for their loved one no longer being in pain. There's relief for the pressure coming off of their own lives as a caregiver. And again, some potentially some guilt in feeling that relief. That really that being able to understand that both and that grief is not just filling up the room on its own, and you struggle with those other emotions along the way, regardless of the loss, the source of the loss. Must be an area that you speak with people saying, all right, I can be in this room and I can sit with my grief, but once I'm out there and I'm navigating all of these different emotions at once, how do I do it?
Yes, there is a visual that I wish I could share with you, but it's a side-by-side picture of two ways we experience grief. Well, the one side of the picture is just this you, and it's what we think is normal for grief, where we, start here and we start grieving, and it gets to a really, really bad place. And then over time, it kind of comes up and gets better. The picture next to it, which is the reality of how we experience grief, is like a hairball of lines going back and forth.
Right.
that you may be up here and then down here and then over here, and so you're absolutely right that there's nothing pretty about it. There's nothing symmetrical about grief. It's just complex. It's all of the emotions at once. It's going back and forth and over long periods of time. And I think that's one of the kind of myths also about grieving, is that if you grieve longer than, say, a year at the loss of a loved one, then something's wrong with you. Then it's pathological grief. Now, in some cases, it can be helpful to talk about it in that way, because there are certain types of interventions and supports that can be very helpful in that case. But in my own experience, and with the experience of people I work with around loss and grief, there's no set time frame. It's not, a year. It can be, I think grief can be a part of our experience for the rest of our lives, and it changes and it softens. And it's not as heavy as it is in the beginning, but it's it's not a circumscribed amount of time or a certain experience that's the same for everyone.
You described your experience as a parent and realizing that your son was not going to have the life that perhaps you had imagined. And certainly the most unimaginable would be, the loss of a child. And I can't imagine somebody saying, "Oh, it's been a year. I think you've grieved long enough over the loss of a child." Like, we would never, I have to believe, as a society, we would never bring that on people. But the idea that you live with this grief, right? Especially, I am thinking about like so many things as a parent, or you talked about the you really wanted children, and of course that was probably a long process to get to, potentially a long process to get to the point where it wasn't going to happen. And living with that grief, finding space for it, finding ways to honor loss, right? We know of lots of people, we have memorials for people. We celebrate anniversaries. We do many things to honor those we've lost. And that to me feels like a productive part of grief. How do you think about things like that?
Oh, I am so glad that you brought that up. I think that in our culture in the past, we have, life has been hard for many people over the centuries. And I think people, especially in the great Midwest where I am from, tend to be stoic and tend to allow themselves a certain window or a certain type of grieving, and then they want to move on and move past it and, not wallow in it or whatever. But can you go back, Kathy, and restate your question really
Sure.
quick?
Yeah. It was the idea of how the act of kind of memorializing and
Oh,
celebrating and
yes.
acknowledging can be a productive part of grief.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes.
Yeah.
So where I was going was that I don't think that we have necessarily emphasized ritual and mourning and all of that very well in our culture. Other cultures that I have learned about and studied and in fact worked in seem to do a better job of that. And for instance, when my mom died, I felt like putting a sign around my neck saying, "My mom died, be gentle with me." And one of my girlfriends pointed out to me, she had lost a brother growing up. And she said, there are cultures where people sit Shiva or where people wear black for a year, or they have the 40 days where the family, gathers and life as usual kind of stops. We don't tend to have that in our culture, and I think it's a detriment really to us because for the grieving person, life as we know it does stop. And so it seems to me that acknowledging that and creating ritual around that can be very helpful for people. And then I was working recently with a young woman in a loss and grief circle from Hanoi, Vietnam, and she was sharing some of the rituals that they have in their culture around staying in touch with their ancestors and giving offerings to them. And she said, was describing some people have these little shrines that look like mailboxes at the end of their walkway, just outside their home. And that they can be kind of a place for the ancestor to come back to, and where you can meet them there and acknowledge them. And I thought, you know what? How lovely would that be to be able to walk out my door every day and acknowledge my ancestors and my loved ones and say, you know what? You are still a part of my life, and I am here because of you, and that's never going to change. And so I think there are other cultures and certain rituals that can be so helpful around grief. And I think we're starting to embrace that a little bit more in American culture, but I think we're still a long way from knowing how to really support people going through these huge changes.
You've mentioned grief circles, and I wanna switch and wanna learn more about that. I think this is a big part of the work that you do with people. I know it's not everything, but can you? And the reason I'm really struck on the words like grief circle as opposed to, oh, this is group therapy. Like you're definitely
Yeah.
not using that language. And
Right.
so let's hear more about that.
Yes. So, circle is a certain format, and I have come to understand that it is a lot like the format used in Al-Anon. It's based on relational healing practices that are really rooted in ancient and indigenous traditions that have been around across cultures for generations. And think about our ancestors coming together around a fire to gather, to listen to each other, to witness each other's experiences, to share information. In the circle format, we all show up as equals. I am the facilitator of the circle, but it doesn't mean that I'm the expert. I just come as myself, offering my own experience, my own thoughts. Everyone speaks to their own experience. It's about sharing. We don't comment on other people's experiences. We are there to share what's going on for us, to be heard, to be witnessed, to be held, and then to do the same for others. So it ends up being a very safe, intentional space where people can, share honestly, listen deeply, support each other. And the wisdom that comes forth from these circles is just incredible. And it's really a shared wisdom that builds as people share their stories and say, that really resonates with me. And when I went through that, this is what I learned. And then someone else will build off of that. And so it kind of emerges through storytelling, shared humanity, reflection, presence. It can be a really powerful format, especially for loss and grief, I think.
A few things that I'm imagining as you're describing that. One is that point of the you're sharing your own experiences. Even when you spoke just at the end about an example where somebody might say, that resonates with me, here's my experience, as opposed to, oh, you know what you should do? You should do X, Y, and Z, right? It's not about telling other people how to grieve, but you can sometimes share lessons in sharing your own experience. But I can see how it's first and foremost the act of sharing and processing your own story, which I'm sure happens and iterates over time, how you even see your own story, but also being able to do it in front of people who are, again, like bearing witness and holding for you, like full on support for where you're at. And being able to hear other people's stories and other people's journeys to inform your own healing and your own work. It sounds like there's such a richness to the whole experience. And depending on the day, you're receiving wisdom or providing wisdom, whatever that is. But it seems like all aspects of that provide growth.
Oh, you describe it just beautifully, and sharing wisdom and gaining wisdom. And I think the power is really in the community. And, I do think that we're going through a little bit of a epidemic of disconnection in our culture, and I'm sure that the COVID epidemic did not help that. And then social media, and there are just many things that are leading to kind of an isolation for people. And I think one of the things that has been so powerful about Circle is people coming together in community, realizing I'm not alone in this. I'm not the first person to experience these emotions. And I may be at a different stage than someone else in the circle in my grieving. And it's helpful to know that they had similar emotions, that they were just as stuck, devastated, whatever, as I am. And that they are in a new phase, and I can learn from that. I can find hope from that, and just that community, that knowing that I'm not alone. I think that's just a huge part of it.
I have to tell you, this conversation is reminding me of my annual Clever Girl Organizing Challenge, which of course is not as heavy as loss and death and grief, but it can be very heavy for a lot of people. There's a lot of shame that people bring. There's a lot of frustration and overwhelm as heavy emotions. And the thing I think I've done best with it over the 13 years that I've done it is build community and building a safe community. It's online, it's Facebook, it's all the things, but it's with some very specific approach of a comment I never want to see is if somebody shares a picture of their kitchen and you say, "Oh my gosh, oh, I wish my kitchen looked like that. You're great. Like, I can't believe you're struggling with that. Like, you shouldn't worry at all. I wish my kitchen were like that." And saying, where I want people,
Disenfranchised.
yes, where I want people to do, and is I want you to recognize that everybody paid their money, everybody joined here because they're struggling. And because their threshold of struggle is different than yours doesn't mean their emotion is any different. And they are here with whatever it is that they brought to say, I don't want to live like this anymore. It's time for me to improve. Even my people who come back every year, they're like, "Yep, I got that one dark corner I hate showing." But it's that idea of creating community through support and sharing, but being really understanding that even the best language, right? We don't tell other people what to do. We would talk about our own experience. All of that. It feels so relatable, and I do know that it's that sense of community, which is why the Clever Girl Organizing Challenge is something that people come back to. There's a million challenges that you can do to figure out how to declutter your home, but I know that my repeat people who come year after year are because they know what an environment I've created through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that strikes me about that, because I probably should attend one of your sessions. I tend to be a little bit of a collector, but the connection around whatever it is, your loss, your grief, your struggle, we now know that that connection is actually protective for both our mental and physical health going forward. So, these community groups, these support systems, really, they're not just to help us get through the moment. Yes, that is kind of the main purpose, but also they set us up for better, outcomes in the future, physically. Grief in itself, we un are understanding, can lead to physical illness, and both acute and chronic. And so, having ways to support each other around this, I think, is more important than we really have acknowledged in the past.
I do want to go back to a topic that was important for me for this session, and that was getting into ambiguous loss. We talked a little bit about it in the beginning. And so as we're talking more about support, I'm thinking about that as being another one of those difficult places to support people. When I think of ambiguous loss, and you spoke about it as like there's no defining end, right? There isn't a closure or defining end. I think of it most often as, I'm caring for an aging parent who is declining, or they're going through dementia or Alzheimer's or some other, a cognitive disease where the person I know is gone and the body is here. Let's talk about other areas where this comes up, but I'd like mostly to talk about, especially us as caregivers navigating through that.
Absolutely. And this, I realize that I've had a very rich life when it comes to experience. I also have lived with ambiguous grief. I was fortunate enough, to have my grandmother live with us for 14 years, when I was a teenager, when I was growing up, as she was declining from Alzheimer's disease, my maternal grandmother. And the experience that I had with that decline was very different than the experience my mom had caring for her. But to get back to your question about ambiguous loss, so I like to acknowledge Dr. Pauline Boss, who has been a professor both in Wisconsin and at the University of Minnesota. And she was the one who coined that term originally. And she describes ambiguous loss as a loss that lacks clear boundaries or resolution, often resulting in frozen grief. Because a person can't find closure. And she categorized ambiguous loss into two distinct types. The one was physical absence with psychological presence. And her research started when she was working with families of soldiers missing in wars. So soldiers, MIA. And so the families, they didn't know if their loved ones were alive or dead. They didn't know where they were. So the loved one was still very emotionally, psychologically present in powerful ways, but physically absent. So how She found that these people really struggled. And another, then the other type of ambiguous grief that she described was when people are physically present and psychologically absent. And that's what you were talking about with dementia. And again, and a lot of people will say, she's not my mother anymore. It's not the same person, but yet I still have to, treat her as if she is this person. And so it becomes a very complex type of loss to deal with. And Pauline Boss, she's written several books, which I really recommend. One is called The Myth of Closure. And she strongly advocates against seeking closure because in this type of loss, that doesn't really exist. So her recommendation is to really work on your psychological resilience so that you're able to live with this ongoing uncertainty. She talks again about the both and mindset. The caregiver might feel that my loved one is gone, and yet they're still really here. So finding that flexibility and resilience to simultaneously hold on to these competing realities, kind of. And she talks a lot about also not fixing again. We can't fix this. The person experiencing ambiguous loss and grief can't fix it. So the objective shifts to meaning making. And to me, that is a really powerful way to work with grief in general, is to try to find some meaning. And for many people, it's like a deeper spiritual meaning, or I think so highly of Patty Wetterling. I don't know if you are familiar with that story. The Wetterling family are from Minnesota. And back, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, their young son was walking home from school and he was abducted. And for maybe 20 years, there was no closure. And she really turned her life into becoming an advocate. She got involved in politics, and became a huge advocate for child safety and made her whole life about protecting and caring for children and families who had dealt with that kind of thing. And to me, that's such a beautiful example of meaning making. So anyway, all of those things are things that Dr. Boss emphasized when it comes to ambiguous grief too.
Well, first of all, I'm going to get all of those references that you mentioned and make sure they're in the show notes. It sounds like some great follow-up reading for the people who are intrigued by our conversation today. I don't even want to go into this detail, but I would be remiss without in saying that I feel like what we've been talking about around loss is so often we're thinking about people we have great relationships with, and there's a lot of love, and there are so many people who are navigating through all of this with a backdrop of, boy, did we have a complicated relationship when all things were going well.
That is so true, Kathy, and I really appreciate you bringing that up. We, I actually had an experience in circle one time in a loss and grief circle where someone was, explaining how devastated they were at the loss of a parent, an aging parent, and we came to the next person in the circle, and she just totally honestly said, you know what? I had a terrible relationship with my parent. I don't miss that person at all, but I'm grieving the fact that I had a terrible relationship with my parent, that I really didn't have that healthy relationship that I wish I had had. So you're right. I mean, it kind of feels like there's an infinite number of possibilities to experience loss all, and really, there are as many different ways to experience loss as there are different people in this universe.
Yeah. It seems inescapable because it is. And I do that notion of thinking about how I can be there for others. And I love that you've brought that highlight to that diminishing language and that disenfranchising language to make sure that when we are trying to be there for somebody, we're doing it in a way that honors what they have, that we're able to sit with them and not try to fix. It seems like that keeps coming up as even as a medical professional, that can be something that we all are so drawn to try and do. I can make it better. I can fix it. How can I fix it? Just tell me. And when we can't.
Yeah.
When you think about resources for the grieving and for the people like me who want to help someone, if somebody wants to be a friend of grieving, you've mentioned a couple of books. You've certainly mentioned circles. And I want to come back. Well, after we do the quicksand three, we'll talk to people about how they can learn more about working with you in a circle. But are there any other kind of resources or tips that you want to give to people about either going through loss and grief or being a support to someone who is?
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the most important things is just being educated about what is loss and grief. What are they? How do they show up? When people understand that grief is not linear, it's not like the U, it's more like the hairball. That grief affects both our brains and our bodies physiologically. And there's a lot of research happening today that illuminates what actually is taking place in the brain. And I find that fascinating information. When people understand that grief can last longer than society expects, all of these things, when they're really educated about it, they can stop judging themselves so harshly and learn to develop that self-compassion, which I think is so important, and compassion toward others in one's life who may be grieving. Supportive practices that I think are really helpful, one-on-one grief therapy or grief coaching. Of course, I'm a huge fan of support groups and circles, grief circles specifically. I think journaling can be very helpful. I also think movement and exercise can be helpful to somatic work, so to speak, to loosen the grief so it doesn't get stuck in our bodies. Some people find mindfulness or meditation supportive or other spiritual practices. Some people find creative expression is helpful. Also, it's really helpful to maintain your routines and to do all of the things that we know are healthy for us, to try to get healthy sleep, maintain regular bedtime routines, to try to eat healthy food, stay away from alcohol during this time because that's a depressant, and then allowing support into one's life. Again, I go back to compassion, self-compassion and compassion toward others instead of criticism, I think is really important. Were you gonna?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you said that last part about kind of allowing support and welcoming support, which is can be the hardest for midlife women whose job it's fully to support others, right? And to recognize you need help, to recognize what help you need, to ask for it, to accept it. Sometimes that can be the hardest part of this journey.
Oh, and so interesting you say that. I actually had a group yesterday, and one of the participants in the group said, "I'm starting to realize that when the plane is going down, I need to put my oxygen mask on before I put on everyone else's." And she said, "I take care of everyone in my life. She is a caregiver by profession. She's caring for elderly parents. She's caring for her own family, children, and husband. And she said she's constantly putting the oxygen mask on everyone else. And she is at a place where she's burned out. And she recognizes finally, I need some support too. So, however, whatever way feels safe and right, and maybe putting your own oxygen mask on means, self-care. Maybe it's not expressing to everyone how you're feeling about everything or, joining a group. Maybe it's just really leaning into self-care. So I think whatever helps renew, rejuvenate, all of those things, taking a warm bath, just I actually did a lot of that when I was grieving the loss of my parents. There were times when my brain wasn't functional. I just didn't feel like I could do anything. But sitting in a hot bath somehow was calming to the nervous system. And, loss and grief get our nervous systems really revved up and overworked. And so sometimes just finding ways to settle our nervous systems can be really helpful too.
You spoke about that physical connection with grief, right? And I think both in terms of how we are impacted and how we can impact it back with things like a warm bath or movement, I think is feels really important. And I have to say, as you're talking about the oxygen mask and self-care, I think there are so many people who don't wait for self-care until it becomes self-rescue.
Right.
And we're no longer nurturing, we're trying to resuscitate, and it is the heartbreak.
Absolutely. And as we know, resuscitation is much harder than prevention.
Absolutely.
So, giving ourselves permission and recognizing too that we really can't do a good job of taking care of those we love if we're not taking care of ourselves. So, I think sometimes just acknowledging that truth can give people a little more permission to, care for themselves.
Larry, I love this conversation. I feel like we've covered so many different grounds, and but it's been really robust. And I'm so grateful that you've shared your many personal experiences as well as your professional insight here. I want to switch to the quicksand three, which are the three questions I ask everyone, and then we'll come back and we'll talk to people, talk to you, give you a chance to talk about how people can find more about you, learn more about grief circles, or anything else that you want to share about how you work with folks. So the first question is, how, when you've been procrastinating or avoiding something, how do you get yourself to actually do it?
Oh, okay. That is a tough one. I thought about that for a little while, and you're probably going to laugh, but one thing that really helps me is taking a power nap. If I'm totally overwhelmed and stuck, sometimes I just have to step away and just give in to relaxation. So that can really help.
Okay, so I have to ask, because we've had a few people who have said sleep or power nap. Are you someone who can truly say, all right, I'm going to go sleep and you can fall asleep and you can wake up in 20 minutes and you can feel refreshed? I am not that person and never have been.
Yeah, I do feel like I'm lucky that way. I am able to nap and feel refreshed, and I know that there are others who are not. But then, for those people, is there, what's their alternative nap type thing? Is it a walk in nature or a warm bath or, reading a book? Just total escapism sometimes, I think, stepping away from whatever it is and, then coming back to it renewed and kind of fresh.
Second question is, if skills and money and time and history and location weren't a factor, is there another career or job you would have tried?
Oh my gosh, yes. And there's more than one. So, oh, I would love to be a professional downhill skier. I
Wow.
ski and I love skiing. And I've always thought, oh my gosh, that would just be so fun. And, I've thought I'd love to go back to seminary or, you know, become a theologian. So, I mean, there are so many different things I'd like to do.
Well,
Who knows where I'll go in my next phase of life.
sure. A professional skier probably not in the cards, but I think theologian is still certainly available to
Right. Options are a good thing, right?
Exactly. And then finally, and we may have already hit on this, but when life gets hectic, how do you recharge or hit the reset button?
Yeah. So similarly, I do like to lay down and I like to either listen to like a meditation app, or I love to listen to podcasts that are, you know, about anything like science, astronomy, cosmology, near-death experiences, anything that reminds me that there is so much more to life than my own little experience, that puts my life into perspective. That is always a really helpful reset for me.
That is really cool. I love that answer. Larry, tell us how people can work with you, how they can learn more about you, how they can learn more about resources like you if they don't want to work virtually and they find somebody where they live.
Absolutely. So, thankfully, there are so many people doing loss and grief work now. For people, well, first of all, my website is called Achieve Health and Wellness Coaching. And I have a resource, several pages of resources of loss and grief information on my website. I also have a page about the circles that I offer, and people can make a quick 15-minute appointment with me to talk about options too. And there's a link to do that on my website.
And the
And
circles are virtual, so people can do that just through video
our
from
circles
home.
are virtual, and we, as I mentioned, I had a woman from Hanoi on my last circle, so I've had people from France, all over the United States. So, yes, they are virtual. And then I offer different types of circles depending on, you know, a person's circumstance. So, I do loss and grief circles for young adults, I do loss and grief circles for older adults. I have never done one explicitly for men, but I am thinking about offering that because I do think there's a gap there in support. But I've had, you know, many, many women participate in our circles. And then I think that I do have Pauline Boss's information in my resources on my website. And I think that I also have the Center for Prolonged Grief from Columbia University on my website. But if I don't, that is also a really helpful resource too. So, and then I think, you know, just doing the research, Googling, there are a lot of people who are starting to offer support for loss and grief. And I do think it matters if you find to someone that you really connect with. So I would encourage people to interview and, you know, don't give up. Don't just pick the first thing that comes along. Find someone who you resonate with.
And you do one-on-one work as well, not just
Yes,
circles. Okay, great.
absolutely.
Yeah. Because I can imagine for some people, the right answer is a combination of all of those things.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Good. Thank you so much, Larry. This has been such a rich conversation. I'm taking so much away from me, and I'm so grateful for your time.
I am so grateful for your time, and I am so grateful for you bringing this information out into the public arena because if I know nothing else, I now know that loss and grief are things that will likely affect every single one of us at some point in our lives. And we don't have, you know, we don't go to school to learn how to deal with it. We don't have, often don't have mentors or Natural supports built into our lives. So I'm so grateful you're bringing this conversation into the public light. It's been so fun, and I wish we had another hour. So thank you so
Thank
much.
you. Thank you. I mean, I could talk to Larry Swanson another 4 hours, and it looks like she was ready to talk about it for another 4 hours with me. I don't know that I had given too much thought to how complicated, complex, intertwined so many different aspects are around loss and grief, the many different types of loss, the way that grief really impacts us in different ways, and for how long, and what we do about it. And really, how do we grieve and how do we support others when they're grieving? There's so much to this. I can see how it can be somebody's life work. And I can see how, with her really, really deep personal experience, she has so much to bear. I couldn't believe one after another, she had another story that really just demonstrated how she's been in this, in the thick of it for so long. And yet, still, through making meaning, has helped people with their own journeys. I hope you got a ton out of this because we are all going to deal with this. And maybe some of the words you heard today will give you comfort when the time comes. Or maybe this is an episode you're going to share with someone who you know is kind of going through it. Thanks so much for being here.